Welcome to the May 2016 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The May issue is on the topic of neurorestoration, reanimating the CNS. In this podcast, we hear a conversation between topic editor Dr. Charles Liu of the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, and Dr. Sarah Bick of Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. They discuss Dr. Bick and colleagues' article, Neuromodulation for Restoring Memory.
Good morning. This is Dr. Charles Liu here with Dr. Sarah Bick. We're here to talk about this publication that will be appearing in Neurosurgical Focus as part of a collection of papers on neurorestoration. The topic we're going to discuss in particular, the paper we're going to focus on, is one on neuromodulation for memory restoration. I'm Charles Liu. I'm a professor of neurological surgery, neurology, and biomedical engineering at the University of Southern California and director of the USC Neurorestoration Center. Dr. Bick, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my name is Dr. Sarah Bick. I'm a neurosurgery resident at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
Wonderful. So this is a very interesting paper in that, in general, people in the functional neurosurgery realm have focused more on, the standard practice of our discipline focuses on issues like movement disorders, et cetera. The area of growth, of course, is in the cognitive space. This paper we selected for this podcast because we think that it really is an area where there's quite a bit of work ongoing now. The work has been, as Dr. Bick, you pointed out in the paper, much of it has been in the form of animal models and experiments. But we anticipate that this work will quickly evolve, hopefully, into clinical trials in the humans. In your paper, you identified quite a few promising targets for neuromodulation. Of the targets that you've identified, can you just quickly give us your thoughts on which of those targets, both cortical and subcortical, et cetera, you and Dr. Eskandar believe to be the most promising going forward?
Sure. So as you point out, there's been work on studying quite a number of different targets for improving memory. I think some of the most promising targets are targets that are part of the circuit of Papez, which is one of the core circuits underlying learning and memory. So first, one of the more studied targets is the fornix. It's part of the circuit of Papez and receives projections from the hippocampus and projects to the mammary bodies. It actually initially came of interest in the study of memory through a study that was being done of deep hypothalamic DBS or BC, where as a side effect of stimulation thought to be related to stimulation of the fornix, a subject actually had elicitation of vivid autobiographical memories. So there's been a fair bit of animal work done of fornicial DBS, and interestingly, even a number of animal models of disorders of a learning and memory, such as dementia and Alzheimer's disease models, have shown promise with fornicial stimulation for improving memory. There is an interesting recent paper, actually, in Rett syndrome mice. Rett syndrome is a developmental disorder where it was found that stimulation of the fornix both improved learning and increased dentate gyrus neurogenesis. It's also been suggested that stimulation at particular frequencies can restore a key rhythm of neuronal firing in the hippocampus that's related to learning and memory, and that's theta frequency firing. The fornix has also been used in one clinical trial of deep brain stimulation for Alzheimer's disease. That trial was a small trial. It involved 6 patients, and the results were somewhat promising, although certainly not definitive. In that trial, there were 2 of the patients who had less than expected worsening of their cognitive function. One had worse than expected worsening, and 3 kind of progressed as expected. But what was more interesting was that stimulation of the fornix was associated with increased activity in several areas that are involved in Alzheimer's disease, such as temporal cortex, parietal cortex, and cingulate. And those changes in activity correlated with cognitive scores. Additionally, in the two patients who had a less than expected worsening, there was an increase in hippocampal volume, which might relate to their less than expected change in cognitive status, and perhaps is even related to the animal model findings of neurogenesis. Interestingly, a stimulation was more effective in patients who had better preoperative function, which might be because earlier in the disease process, projections between hippocampus and fornix are more intact and maybe could be better augmented. A second target that's also involved in the circuit of Papez that perhaps a little less studied but also very promising is entorhinal cortex. Entorhinal cortex receives projections from the cingulate cortex and projects back to hippocampus. There have been a number of very interesting animal studies which have shown excellent evidence that stimulation increases dentate gyrus neurogenesis and have even linked this neurogenesis to improvements in spatial memory performance. It's also been studied in an animal dementia model and been shown to improve memory. And interestingly, a study in human subjects which used epilepsy subjects who had depth electrodes placed for seizure localization found that when entorhinal cortex was stimulated during the learning phase of spatial learning tasks, subjects had better recall of location of spatial landmarks. And then finally, a different target, one that's not involved in that kind of key memory circuitry, but is very much involved in the disease process of both Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease dementia. It's the nucleus basalis of Meynert. It provides cholinergic innervation to the cortex, which modulates widespread cortical networks that are involved in cognitive function. It's known that cholinergic function is required for formation of new memories. In animal models, stimulations of this nucleus has been shown to increase acetylcholine release and also to improve memory. There have been a couple of case reports in an Alzheimer's disease patient and a Parkinson's disease patient, which have also been very promising in human disease subjects, suggesting the stimulation of this nucleus might improve memory. And there's currently a clinical trial actually ongoing in Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you very much for that excellent discussion. I think that that's going to be extremely helpful because I think that as our audience reads your review, the first question is going to come up is, okay, there are all these wonderful targets to study, and which one of these are, in fact, the most promising? I think that's excellent. One other thought that comes to mind, I think, as we think through the discussion in your paper, is the translation or the step taken to go from, you know, laboratory studies to human clinical trials are usually not trivial. There are certainly barriers to clinical application in humans. You mentioned earlier that it may be that degenerative processes that are relatively early on in its age are in fact more amenable to these types of neuromodulation approaches, and yet these in fact are the patients that have, I suppose, the most risk in terms of what they might lose if things don't go perfectly. Do you have any thoughts about what these barriers for clinical application might be and how we as a field, you know, working, you know, scientific people in clinical practice as well as with the medical industry and what steps we can take to mitigate these barriers?
Sure. So memory itself is a complicated topic to study and try to improve the function in memory disorders. You know, there are different types of memory, short-term memory, long-term memory, implicit memory, or memory with unconscious recall and explicit memory, which involves a conscious recall. There's some differences in the neural circuitry underlying these different types of memory. And when we look at different memory disorders, there's also different pathologies and anatomy underlying these disorders, which kind of complicates finding perhaps a one-size-fits-all solution to these problems. Some other difficulties are that, well, we study stimulation of various targets for improving memory in animals. Tests of memory in animals may not directly translate into memory in humans or functional gains in humans. Humans have much more complex and sophisticated memory systems. I think there's also a number of ethical issues that we have to consider as potential barriers for studying neuromodulation for memory. For one, patients with dementia have some ethical issues of consent. And then there's a kind of a larger overlying question of, if we're looking at neuromodulation for improving memory, what about improving memory in people with normal function? What are the ethics of that? Some of the things I think that will help to ultimately translate some of this work into studies in humans is, first of all, just further understanding and study of the underlying pathophysiology of different disease processes and the neural circuitry underlying memory, which will help us better select and modulate specific targets. Further animal studies are needed, even within the most promising targets we know, to better characterize different stimulation targets and stimulation parameters for those targets to optimize, ultimately, human trials and their outcomes. One way that we can further study some of these targets is by taking advantage of some of the access that we have in existing neurosurgical patients. So, for example, epilepsy patients, frequently patients who are undergoing depth electrode implantation for seizures, the medial temporal lobe structures are often involved in epilepsy and often explored through this method. They're also involved in memory, and so I think there's more we can do with studying these targets in patients who already have kind of invasive monitoring. There's also a number of non-invasive methods that can be used to study neuromodulation. Finally, ultimately, overall, we're going to need some larger clinical trials of the most promising targets. They're well-designed with blinded stimulation status and strict inclusion criteria and outcome measures to help us really fully utilize and discover the benefit of neuromodulation for memory.
Well, that's really great. I think that most of our readership will be very keen in understanding what we can all do collectively to advance this field. You know, I think that we all recognize that issues related to cognitive disorders ultimately are the ones that are perhaps the most challenging for us to deal with. You had mentioned in your last comment about these non-invasive strategies for neuromodulation. You know, I think generally when a neurosurgeon thinks about neuromodulation, they think in terms of, you know, the DBS electrode applying modulation with electrical currents. You had mentioned non-invasive approaches. Interestingly, at the Brain Initiative PIs meeting, one-third of the discussion on the final day was focused on these non-invasive strategies. What are your thoughts about how neurosurgery should embrace these non-invasive strategies? Because at some level, it doesn't really require our specific operative skills, right? So do you think that, and yet in the whole realm of neuromodulation, neurosurgeons are very much present and working in this area. How do you see these invasive and non-invasive strategies sort of coexisting?
Yeah, so I think they each have their role. There's a number of very interesting and promising non-invasive techniques. One of those is repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS. Which uses magnetic pulses to induce an electric current and induce a change in neural activity, which has been shown to be able to change connectivity within a stimulated network. And then another is transcranial direct current stimulation, which uses a direct current through stimulation through two electrodes placed on the scalp. And there's two types of stimulation, anodal stimulation, which depolarizes and is activating, or cathodal stimulation, which hyperpolarizes and is deactivating. Both of these have been used in a number of ways to alter activity of structures, felt to be involved in learning and memory with some interesting changes or benefits to memory. I think one, as we kind of touched on earlier, one interesting potential use to neurosurgeons of these methods is that they're a great tool to study potential targets of neuromodulation or to study potential mechanisms of action of other forms of neuromodulation that we have. And perhaps it could be even used in combination with some of the more invasive methods to target multiple areas and you know, work together to strengthen neural networks involved in memory. I don't think that they're fully going to replace, at least at this point, more invasive strategies. They have some limitations, including the depth of targets that can be modulated. Only more superficial targets can really be accessed through these methods at this time. And then there's also questions about the durability and the frequency of treatments needed to maintain an effect that differs from an implanted, more invasive neuromodulation strategy, has a more permanent duration and more flexibility in terms of structures that can be targeted.
Yeah, I think I would agree with most of those comments made. I think that it's real important for all of us to understand the various options that exist, and it's familiar in almost all the new technologies that have come into our field that we have to understand how it fits within the context of our existing paradigm and how to see what a potential benefit exists in a synergistic way. This is really a great discussion. I think that the last issue I think that we'd want to touch on is all around the world, particularly if you look at our situation here in North America, people talk about efficacy, but in the end, much of the discussions is centered around access to care and effectiveness. You know, I like to always make the point that the FDA is full of efficacious class one data. Right, and yet we see many neuromodulation devices and strategies that don't see wide-scale application because of systems-related access issues and also the issue of scalability. You know, in the end, if we're going to take care of memory cognitive issues on a large scale, you know, any technology that we invent has to be scalable, I suppose, in order for it to be effective. Do you have any comments about how these types of technologies that we've discussed in the paper so far might be scalable in a large way that becomes cost effective?
Sure. So I think, you know, when we think about deep brain stimulation, we think of it as it's an expensive, perhaps more invasive treatment. But you have to think about what the cost and burden of disorders of memory really are in our society. Dementia has a huge monetary cost in the United States. It's been estimated to range from $160 to $215 billion annually. A lot of the costs associated with dementia are not necessarily from the direct medical treatment, but the costs associated with providing long-term care to patients and economic burdens to caregivers. It's actually been estimated to be more expensive than heart disease or cancer. Traumatic brain injury as well also has a large cost annually, and patients with traumatic brain injury often are younger and have a longer time to potentially benefit from a surgical treatment, which could, you know, potentially improve their quality of life and productivity and economic productivity for many years ahead. So I think that when we're thinking about the cost and feasibility of providing this treatment to larger numbers of people, we have to consider also the cost of not treating these diseases. In Parkinson's disease, there's actually been several studies of cost effectiveness of deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease, and it's been found in a number of studies that there are really significant gains in quality of life for the cost of surgery, and the cost for the improvement seen is really quite reasonable compared to many other treatments in wide use in medical practice. Some of the greatest costs associated with DBS are just initial surgery and then also battery replacement. So I think there are some strategies we could use to kind of reduce some of these costs, perhaps having better rechargeable batteries, or even, you know, different stimulation parameters might be effective in memory where there's not constant stimulation, perhaps, and batteries weren't drained as quickly. Overall, I think when there's greater utilization of this technology, it's also just going to lead to improved production of improved devices and more competition in the market. I think it's overall probably, you know, the cost of this one surgery are likely, if it results in significant benefits in quality of life and ability of people to perhaps take care of themselves and reduce some of the cost of long-term care, it could be quite feasible.
As I hear you go through these arguments in support of, you know, the cost benefit of doing deep brain stimulation, neuromodulation with devices, it certainly makes a lot of sense. I think that one thing that we really should keep in mind is that other than making an economic argument, there's the issue of scalability in terms of number of surgeons needed to perform these operations to take care of the millions and millions and millions and millions of people worldwide that may potentially benefit. And so I suppose one of the things that we all ought to do is encourage young neurosurgical trainees to think about going into the functional neurosurgery space and also to think about ways our efforts can be magnified. This may be one of the areas where the synergies between these non-invasive and invasive ways might be evident. So, well, this has certainly been a wonderful discussion on this topic. At this point, I'd like to ask Dr. Bick if you have any final comments regarding this, and if not, I think we can conclude here.
I think that's it. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This concludes our podcast for the May issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the June issue, when the topic will be cervical spondylotic myelopathy with and without OPLL. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is contained in the AANS iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for JNSPG and AANS podcasts and videos. Content is updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.